Welcome back to Planet Waves FM's continuing coverage of the United Astrology Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana. My name's Eric Francis, your host for days on end. For those of you who love the Planet Waves FM podcast, well, now you get to have about seven editions a day. We're ending the afternoon with someone who I introduced earlier as one of the patron saints of Planet Waves, Melanie Reinhardt, author of Chiron and the Healing Journey and To the Edge and Beyond, Saturn, Chiron, and the Centaurs, as well as Incarnation, a book about the angles and the nodes, I think, are included
in
Incarnation.
Great.
Yeah. So welcome back to Planet Waves FM, Melanie. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And we tend to always have
likewise.
Recording apparatus involved. In
I know we do.
All right. So you can back off that mic just about 1 inch, just about 4 inches. There you go. Good. All right. So we're clipping a little bit there. All righty. Now that we've got that out of the way, welcome. What did you teach in the pre-conference intensive? What was
I did a half day on the angles, which I enjoyed hugely. It was a really, really nice group.
Right.
And, you know, I said in sort of introducing that day, one of the lovely things about doing a lecture or a workshop and so forth is the preparation period where you get to focus in deeply on something.
Your topic, yes.
Yeah. And every time I do that, no matter what the topic is, I always end up thinking, this is the most important thing in the chart or the most important thing to follow when you're doing a reading.
Well, there's
it doesn't matter what it is.
Well, there's a good case to be made for the angles about that, though.
Absolutely. But I also...
But you notice this prioritization thing where it comes up as the thing.
Yes. And so what that reminds me of is the kind of holographic nature of astrology, you know, where you can take one little tiny corner of it. And if you know how to apply yourself to that, it can mushroom out into something very big and very whole in a way, and that really does show when you work with the nodes, the nodes and the angles,
right, which are considered the personal points in some forms of astrology.
Yes.
Do you include the Aries point in that, the position of the Aries point? Because in Uranian astrology, that grouping is the Aries point's included in that grouping.
I tend to do that. I don't actually mark it into my charts.
Right.
But
It's there.
It's there as a point of reference, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how would you sum up your take on the angles and the nodes working together?
Well...
And we should say what the angles are.
Yes.
Well, they're the... First of all, it's easy to understand the rising sign, the ascendant. That's that's the main angle in the chart. And then there's a degree. There's a sign rising, but there's also a degree rising. So you've got an exact address that was in the zodiac that was on the eastern horizon at the moment your chart is timed for.
Correct.
That corresponds with the seventh house cusp. But now with the midheaven, with the MCIC axis, that's often mistaken for the 10th and 4th, but there's often a little bit of a difference between the actual MC and the 10th.
Yes, that depends on which house system is used, but...
Which one lines them up? Which one uses the MC as the 10th house cusp?
Well, all of them except for the equal house system or whole houses.
Ah, so you're saying that like Koch, Placidus, they all use the actual MC
as the
10th house
cusp. Yes.
Okay, great, so that settles that issue.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the meridian, basically. That's the place that will be the zenith at that moment.
Yes, and the symbolism is so beautiful because what that midheaven point refers to is in the word itself, midheaven, and it's the point in the sky where the sun rises to its height on any given day. So like the noonday sun is up there. The highest point, therefore the brightest point, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so the symbolism of it speaks to that.
Right.
It's like a point of aspiration. It's where we're not only reaching for our own highest, but it's sort of a fully illuminated place. And I think of the midheaven also as the place that says something about what the world asks of you. And... like all of the houses the angular houses, which relate to the angles, obviously.
So that'll be the first house.
First house, fourth house.
Which relates to the IC.
Yes.
And then the seventh house relates to the descendant.
And the tenth house relates to the midheaven. And all of them have many, many layers of meaning that go from things collective and external all the way into very deep internal things, mm-hmm. which are, you know, quote-unquote, invisible.
And then ancestral in some cases.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Right, so they're very multi-purpose.
Very much so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In a way similar to the Aries point, they also have a nodal quality between individual and collective.
Yes, I think so. And there's a sort of structural feeling about what the angles say to us.
Mm-hmm.
I always draw my own charts with the angles all perpendicular at 90 degrees to each other.
So visually?
Yes, visually. And even though that's perhaps not the most correct way to draw a chart astronomically, but in my way of feeling it, it's symbolically very correct,
mm-hmm.
Because the whole symbolism of the cross within the circle is really what you're contemplating as you work with the angles.
Mm-hmm.
And if we unpack that, you know, the circle in sacred geometry is considered to be one of the prime forms. It's like a mark of infinity, because the line which bounds the circle has no beginning and no end. And it is at the same time something quite individual, because it's a line, therefore it bounds a space. Outside is infinite space, inside is something more definite. And it's so lovely to contemplate this. And then if you put a cross in the middle of a circle, some cameras, you'd know this, some cameras have that exact symbol as their view finder.
And rifles.
Yes, yes.
The crosshairs is
crosshairs,
the international
in the crosshairs,
symbol of the
in
rifle.
The crosshairs, yes. Exactly. So it provides like a view finder, or also like shows the target or the aim, where to aim. And, you know, in the prototype of the angles, of which, of course, most charts are a variant of that, but in the prototype, each angle would belong to a different element, and prototypically would be in the same mode, cardinal, fixed, or mutable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mainly charts where the nearer you were born to the equator, the more likely it is that you'll turn up one of those prototype sets of angles. Usually, you know, most of us have a mix of that.
Yeah, I mean, I have my ascendant, descendant, and cardinal, and then I have my MCIC and mutable.
Right. There's an example.
But that's also called a mundane square. If I have, for example, Chiron on the midheaven and the north node rising, they're in a trine, water to water, but what my
yes.
astrology teacher said, well, that's called
yes.
a mundane square.
Yes.
That they're square as you like to draw your mundane square with 90-degree angles, even if it's all in the water signs or something like that.
Exactly.
You want to see that visually, the square relationship
yeah.
between them. Okay, so what do you think these points aren't for us?
You mean the angles?
Yes.
Well,
to anchor things
yes,
in a way.
Yes, exactly. In my presentation, I showed quite a lot of pictures. I always like to work with images. And for example, there's lots of Tibetan tankas, which are very much fourfold and often set within a circle.
What is a tanka? Is like a mandala?
Oh, yes, a tanka is like it's like a visual meditation aid.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often those images represent the foursome of literally the four directions, and often when ceremonies are set up, and this is across many traditions actually, they begin with addressing the four cardinal directions, sometimes with an added layer of an association with an element and a color and what I pointed out was that if you do a kind of search across different cultures with that, you'll find that there are different associations. like, you know, not all cultures associate the same direction with the same element, for example.
Right.
And I was encouraging people not to feel perplexed by that, but to just look at the geography and the natural surroundings of the place within which those associations arose.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you live in the Northern Hemisphere, it makes sense that south would be fire, because the sun is always seen, as it were, southerly.
Yes.
And just simple things like that.
Right.
You know, and I pushed the envelope a little further and said, well, actually, you can make your own set of associations and orientations to enter your own sacred space using the horoscope and the angles. So to me, the angles are like doorways, mm-hmm. portals,
mm-hmm.
which are like entry points into this very potent structural element of what shows in the chart.
It's kind of the framework of the chart, really, the angles.
Yes.
And the angular houses.
Yes, so very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So it's a simple way to evaluate your chart if you're not that advanced.
Sure.
Is notice what's in those angular
yeah.
houses.
Absolutely.
And I give a kind of a special place to things that are leaning up against, say, for example, something in the ninth house.
Yes.
Like someone maybe has Mars in the ninth, 1 degree away from the...
Yes.
Now, Martha Lang Westcott, another one of my patron saints,
mm-hmm.
Talks about... I think those have... That anything near the cusp of any house, I
yeah.
think that there's a transitional area.
Absolutely.
And that it's kind of operating on a semi-conscious, semi-unconscious
yes.
level, sort of floating around.
Yes.
And that it's almost trying to get there, or it has a kind of a legacy value
yes.
to it.
Yes.
There. So, okay. Okay.
Yes. And I like the phrase that you used there, leaning into.
Mm-hmm.
And adding to that, I sometimes when I'm teaching describe it as knocking on the door of the next house,
mm-hmm.
if it's exiting, you know, in the usual direction that we measure the movement. If it's just in one of the houses, you can think of it. It's just closing the door behind it, or maybe, you know, putting on its outdoor shoes or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's they're places of transition, essentially.
Yes, and I think need to be handled with extra consciousness. You know, if you.
I agree, and you know, and another thing about the angles that's very particular is that anything that's close to one of the four angles is very likely to manifest in a very real, concrete, literal way in somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you know, it's not so much a question of, well, what kind of orb do I use? It's a very simple rule of thumb that says the closer something is to an angle, the more likely it is to manifest
mm-hmm.
in a very, very graphic way in one's life.
As a real thing.
As a real thing.
Yep.
And I also mentioned there the, to me, intriguing question of birth times, and sometimes they need adjusting, and sometimes they're completely wrong, sometimes we don't know them at all. And this is where one's awareness of the angles and what's going on around them can be incredibly useful, because mm-hmm. usually you can pinpoint things in a very precise way using the angles.
And transits to the angles.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did speak about that too, and those transits, whether they're long-term transits or brief short-term triggers, those are what we use when we're trying to adjust the time of a chart.
Yeah, most rectifiers will look at transits to the angles or proposed
yes.
angles and see if it works.
Exactly.
That's really what you're doing.
Yes.
So what about the rulers of the angles? Say, for example, someone has Aquarius on the midheaven and then looking at Saturn. You know, how much
yes.
do you find that the planet that rules the sign that the cusp is through
yeah.
Influences that house's manifestation?
Very strongly. In fact, there's sort of, again, it's like peeling the onion, you know. So, if you're considering a planet in a house, then looking at the sign on the cusp of that house, even if it's not the same sign as the planet's in,
mm-hmm.
so looking at the sign there, and then looking at the ruler of that sign and where that's placed and its condition in terms of aspects or maybe proximity to an angle or any other distinguishing features that you see about it. Mm-hmm. And then also, of course, looking in at the planet itself and what sign it's in and what sign rules that one. So there can be two layers of little trails there. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, there's like the kind of natural or archetypal rulers of the houses, which are the same as the signs 1 through 12. So if we are talking about the 10th house, say, well, the natural ruler associated with that would be Capricorn and Saturn via Capricorn. Mm-hmm. And that's a sort of resonance in the background, which may or may not be picked up by the details.
What about the theme of Mundi, which is, you know, recently been revived? I mean, people have known about it for a while, but now it's, you know, commonly available. That's the zodiac that sets up the, it's a teaching chart, and there's Cancer in the ascendant. So that in the theme of the world, the chart of the world, it's not Aries on the first, it's Cancer on the first with the moon there. And I call this the 90-degree shift.
Mm-hmm.
How does that factor into things, do you think? I mean, is it a second take on this where we could look at therefore Aries would be on the midheaven, which actually makes sense.
Makes sense. While I think of it, on that subject, you know, one of the things that I sort of almost spotted by accident, as you do, because I Sun in Gemini, you keep spotting things by accident, you know. And this, I think, is in my book Incarnation. But anyway, it's the fact that, you know, the cardinal signs are all to do with the domicile of Mars anyway. So Aries is the dignity of Mars. Cancer is the fall. Libra is the detriment. And Capricorn is the exaltation.
Right.
And I got very, very excited about that, because what that said to me was, wow, what's represented by the angles, given that they, as it were, represent the cardinal signs, even if they're mutable or fixed or whatever, but symbolically,
well, in a cardinal way.
Exactly, they represent
way.
That.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I've always thought of the angles as something that calls for action,
exactly.
Talks about action.
Exactly.
And that, you know, if it's a little bit before, late in the ninth, maybe that's like where you got to give things a little bit of a push.
Yeah.
And find that motivation point.
But I thought that it was, to me, that was so interesting because it kind of flagged up the significance of that very important theme as to what we do with our Mars energy being, as it were, incarnate on this planet, where the next one out from us is Mars. So it's our neighbor.
Yes.
And if we look at the world and a lot of the suffering in the world, without generalizing to absurdity, we could say, well, quite a lot of it, in terms of the difficult things we see and the suffering that we see, is a result of the misuse, the misapplication of Mars energy.
Yep.
And it takes a great deal of wisdom and strength and skill to really ride with and direct and engage with Mars energy appropriately. And I think that's true for both men and women. I don't agree that Mars is a symbol that only belongs to men,
well,
or that Venus only to women. In fact, actually, I think that all the planets have both within them.
Sure. I mean, I've read for lots of women, I haven't seen it drop Mars out of the chart once. I mean, the thing
right.
is that this is one of the beautiful things about astrology, is that we all have the same set of, depending on what planets you use, but still, we all have the same solar system. We all have Venus, Mars, we all have Moon and Sun.
Mm. But going back to the Cancer rising chart.
Yes, yep.
I suppose my thought about that is that might be some kind of background, almost like group soul field.
Mm-hmm.
And foreground is the chart with all the angles inferring the domicile of Mars. So inferring
individuation. But they still would be inferring that because it's the same it's still the cardinal points. It's a 90-degree shift, so it's a
Yes, but the ascendant is Cancer.
Yes.
Which is the moon.
So that's what the Sumerians or whoever, the Babylonians, believed that the chart began with. Which is interesting, since life does begin with Mom.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And I like the implication that it is it's illustrating humanity as being more nurturing,
yes,
than having this inherent quality of identity with Mars. And I think that we are way too hot on the Mars energy. We overvalue competition, mm, as opposed to commitment,
yeah,
and nurturing, and
yeah,
everything becomes a game. Mm. And
yes,
ultimately you kill someone. I mean, yeah, that's, and you can get killed. You know, how much of unconscious fear is, I can't do that because I'm going to get killed.
Yeah.
I can't say that. I can't speak that up because I will, yeah, encounter death in some way or the sword.
Yeah.
Which is Mars issues, more Mars,
yes,
issues. Everyone,
yes,
knows people have Mars issues.
Mm-hmm. So almost like it's when contact is lost with that moon side, the nurturing side, that things become out of balance on the Mars side, we could say that.
Yeah, and they have been for quite a while. I mean,
yeah,
I know this Thema Mundi, there's several of them, but I think they mostly have Cancer in the ascendant. Was, you know, you could have dug it up out of old texts, but most people wouldn't, who knew what those texts were, wouldn't know what the Thema Mundi was. Would have been just some mysterious document,
yes,
in there, and it was. And I know there's a history that predates Rob Schmidt explaining it to us, but basically it was Rob Schmidt who dusted it off and explained it,
indeed,
to us. And apparently Demetra is, according to Rob Hand, one of the people who knows the most about the Thema Mundi in the world, and
yes,
she's researched the various versions of it.
Yes,
and it seems to be, like a lot of things from that era, an agricultural tool. It's based on an agricultural,
yeah,
concept, and of course, Cancer in the ascendant would support that. We've got to eat,
yeah, absolutely,
and take care of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
So what have you been up to with the minor planets lately? What's your pet?
My pet minor planet.
These days, is it Orcus? I hear?
It is. It is.
Right. I heard a rumor about this.
Yeah.
I've taken a shine to that one, too.
Have you?
I like that it's Etruscan.
I know.
It's pre-European.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you how that came about,
mm-hmm,
that I got interested
let's
in
hear,
it. Because,
let's hear it. Yep.
Because I think that, in a way, it illustrates something which I think I've probably mentioned to you before, so forgive me for being repetitive.
Happy to hear it again. Yes.
This is a quote from Rick Tarnas,
mm-hmm,
and it was in response to a question by a student.
Should you use the minor planets? And he said, what's burnished in your soul.
Correct. You got it.
Yeah, that's the right answer, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the right answer. So when something gets burnished into your soul, for whatever reason, you know, then you can fruitfully follow it, and it speaks, and you listen, and a whole process takes place.
I seem to have the categories burnished in my soul. The individuals, I just burnish a little bit more, and I see them all, basically.
Right, yes.
They're all useful.
Yes,
I mean, they're all such good dogs. I mean,
absolutely.
You whistle, and they want to help. You know, they really,
absolutely,
they really come to you. So Orcus is a pre-Pluto. It's kind of a proto-Pluto, in a way,
yes,
I think of it as.
The mythological sources for Orcus are quite scant in a way.
It's old.
It's, yes, possibly Etruscan, but not really known. Shares a lot of the characteristics with some of the later underworld deities.
Mm-hmm.
For example, having the epithet the Lord of Wealth, and also being described as the one who punishes those who break their oaths and vows and promises.
Yes.
That actually is very meaningful if you take the crime and punishment stuff out of it, because then it becomes, okay, this represents a being or an energy who is like the guardian of the oaths of the soul.
Yes. There's a justice element to it, and there's a respecting the agreements that we make.
Yes.
Element to that, and the commitments that we,
yes,
make. He's a little like Varuna in that regard. Varuna is one of the enforcers. And
correct.
I've identified a cycle of myth that is the enforcer of oath cycle.
Okay.
Right, because there's two that I know of so far, Varuna and then Orcus, have that similar flavor to them.
Yes, and slightly similar in the Greek mythology. It was said that Hades was the only god whose word was absolute. No bargaining, no wiggle room, etc. That was it. And that's got a bit of a similar flavor.
Right. The final arbiter.
Yeah. What was very interesting for me about the sort of path that opened up for me with Orcus was it was when I made the connection between the name Orcus and, you know, the little bit of mythology that's there about Orcus, which for me wasn't really enough to run with. It was, you know, a little bit there. But it was when I made the connection to the orca. So
Orca.
Oh,
ah, well, yes.
Yes.
Killer whale.
Yeah.
But not really.
Exactly. So the species of which the orca is a part, it's called Orcus orcinus.
What does the second word mean?
I think orcinus.
You can pick it up in Wikipedia.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But it's got that orc in it again. Almost like... let's see what the wiki god says.
I just assumed that word meant sort of like the generic of the species, you know, Orcus orcinus is the species. And as you say, killer whale, but not quite. That's quite true, because they're not whales at all, actually.
No, they're big.
They're
dolphins, right.
Yeah. And when I began to read about their habits and characteristics, the whole thing began to take off in the synchronicity and the symbolism, because, for example, orcas are matrilineal and they pretty much breed inside their own pod. And it's a very, very ancient species. Now, the dolphin species is, they think, more than 5 million years old. And the orcas are a subspecies of the dolphins, and they don't know exactly at what point
it branches off,
but it could be all the way back to 5 million years. But at any rate, they are very ancient. So I suddenly thought, oh, well, if they're that ancient and they're matrilineal and they breed inside their own pod, then what the energy represents is like this pure gene pool of feminine instinctual energy. Then it started to make sense in my mind of what it is that people feel when they go swim with the dolphins, and the amazing healing experiences that probably most of your listeners will have read about, or many of them even had themselves. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful descriptions of what people feel, and it's like the deep wounds about maternal infant bonding are touched by these beautiful playful creatures. Mm-hmm. Now, the orca, the quasi killer whale, was demonized or monsterized partly through the movie Jaws.
But it was the great white in Jaws.
Yes, but it was still one of the great big sea mammals, if you see what I mean. And it sort of becomes generic in the imagination.
Right.
And something very disturbing and sad, I find, is, you know, all the studies about orca behavior that flag up some of its more apparently vicious forms of hunting, those studies are not very old, so we haven't been studying the orcas for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. We've only been studying them for about 150 years. And during that time period, pretty much, this is when the seas have become the dumping ground for all the toxins, the toxic waste of human industrial endeavor, etc. Most of it ends up in the sea at some point or another.
Yeah.
Including a lot of heavy metal. And, you know, the flesh of these poor creatures, the large sea mammals, dolphins.
That are high on the food chain.
Yeah, exactly.
And they eat a lot of other fish.
That's right. They are the most toxic creatures on the planet. Yeah. And you know, heavy metal toxicity in anybody's brain turns people nuts. So I think, this comes into my mind when I read, you know, studies about orca behavior and all that. I think, well, actually, what are we really studying, the creature in its true natural splendor or not? What's true is that they do have very sophisticated hunting techniques. I think the viciousness that's imputed to them is in question, at least in my mind. Animals are not vicious. They just do what they need to do, you know. But what is interesting, and you can start to see it speaking symbolically, is the orbit of orcas is pretty much an exact match of the orbit of Pluto, but the other way around. So,
you mean the perihelion and aphelion are reversed?
No, not quite. If we think of the ecliptic, I always think of it as the great fried egg in the sky. Okay, the sun is in the yolk, and the planets are on the flat white, you know, if it's a fried egg. And then the orbit of Pluto kind of cuts through that because it's quite elliptical, for one.
So. And it's a bit cometary also. It's on that, it's angled.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
it's,
20
it's
degrees
angled,
or something like that.
Yes. Now, the orbit of Orcus is almost exactly the same length, elliptical like Pluto, and its angle is the same, but in the other direction. So your listeners won't see this, but I'm making a kind of elongated cross with my arms as I'm explaining this
to
you.
And that will form some nodes. There's crossover points between them.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, have you figured out where they are?
I don't have it in my head. I've got it in my notes. But so they are like a mirror image of each other in some very, very interesting way. Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed with orcas is a number of things which I'll list, and actually there's a huge amount of stuff already about this on my website if any listener's really interested. Mm-hmm. But because it's in such an interesting place right now, it's at 2 degrees of Virgo, and you know there are 17 oppositions between Orcus and either Chiron or Neptune starting already couple of years back, mm-hmm. and going on for many years. And here an extraordinary symbolic showing is April 20th, 2010 was the day that Chiron went into Pisces.
For the first time.
Yep. And it was the deep water horizon.
Yep, only about 23 hours later.
That's right. So it was the sea was wounded, Chiron in Pisces. 2 days later was the first exact conjunction of opposition of Orcus and Chiron, and that was the day that the rig actually went down.
Right.
And there's still video footage of that on YouTube. Quite extraordinary, because it really does look like a sea monster.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost the...
Yeah, I'm wondering where that went. Hold on a second. Is it back now?
Yeah.
Nope. And then it seems to be cutting out again. Huh. Right, well, we can edit this out. Let's hold on a second. This is the... I live in Dallas. A couple years ago, I introduced it in the Joey Street. Let's see. That's funny. So far, so good today with this. Let's start a new file.
Okay.
Okay, so on the day of this Deepwater Horizon thing, it was not only Chiron ingressing Pisces, but it was actually making an exact opposition to Orcus in the first degree of Virgo.
Yes, and that was exact on the 22nd, 2 days later.
Right.
And that was the day that the actual rig sank.
Right.
And it's the pictures of that absolutely struck me, because it's like flames and black smoke belching out of the sea, like the sea monster that Orcus was supposed to have been. It was very, very striking.
Yeah, it's almost like it's reveals that the whole thing is a human construction.
Yes.
It's a human projection.
Yes.
And that, you know, a volcano going off under the sea is one thing, but when we make one of these evil things with 600,000 gallons of diesel fuel on board, and there's really no provision taken at all for safety, there's no respect whatsoever with this thing. And then the whole thing's designed by Halliburton and their dodgy practices.
And then also, you know, in the so-called cleanup which has followed, I watched some very disturbing interviews with people who were getting toxic rain. This is in the States.
Yep.
You know,
right in the Gulf Coast, right where we are now.
Yeah. You know, whose farmlands have been ruined, and so it goes on.
Yeah, this is one of those things that doesn't reverse itself because it just, I mean, it goes into the Gulf Stream. That connects every current. It's really one of the master currents on the planet. It goes right in.
Yeah.
The stuff will be in Africa. I mean, washing up on beaches in Africa because the Gulf Stream crosses the Atlantic and then picks up a new current and runs straight down the coast of Europe and the coast of Africa.
Yeah. So, you know, the emphasis on the sea, literally and symbolically, is enormous at the moment. We have Neptune in Pisces, which is home ground or home water for Neptune. Chiron in Pisces, meaning many people born during the 1960s are having their Chiron return because Chiron takes 50 years to go round once. Then we've got Orcus.
And then Varuna in Cancer.
Varuna. And, well, a few years ago, Sedna was discovered. That's another pointer to the sea.
Yep. And though in Taurus, that's going to last forever and ever.
Yes,
But it's still...
It's still bringing stories of the sea and the sea deities and the sea creatures.
And in particular, the North Pole. I mean, I'm a big fan of the Mike Brown Planet Naming Committee.
Yes.
They seem to always get it right.
Yes.
And they know what they're doing in a way. They are. They're looking to connect it to contemporary events.
Yes.
You know, they're the ones who named Eris. I mean, it couldn't be more perfect. I mean, they...
Yeah.
And when I talked to Chad, who was the discoverer of Kwa Oar, about the naming of Eris, which he was involved with the naming of Eris, and he said, well, you know, it just seemed like the thing to name it because there's so much chaos on the planet right now. Mm. It just seemed like the thing to do.
Yeah.
Is what he said.
Yeah, perfect. And, you know, through one means or another, the general awareness of the significance of water, both the sea and also fresh water, drinking water, is steadily becoming a really major issue.
Have you been following the hydrofracking issue?
Yes. Oh, it's also happening in the UK at the moment.
Yeah. Mm. It's hard to think of something. It's right up there with nuclear power
Absolutely.
As pure, unmitigated evil.
Yeah. Just like a force of destruction.
Yeah. Under the ground. Mm. And yet it the amount of water that it takes to even dig the well, they have to truck in like 300 trucks of water to dig the well, and then they end up with contaminating the whole atmosphere above the well.
And the water table.
The water table is obviously just ripped apart, and they inject all this hydraulic fluid and benzene down there. All the stuff we spent the entire 1970s and 80s figuring out how toxic it was, they're just injecting it into the wells.
Yeah.
And only 1% of the water on the planet anyway is potable water. 99% of the water is seawater. There's just 1%. Fortunately, there's a lot of water. But the water crisis is a huge crisis. It's not being helped by fracking. I mean, I can't even believe that it's happening. Mm. And I mean, it seems like part of the satanic plan to make people feel helpless.
Yeah. I think that the symbolism of water also is so important because it's like a symbol for our sense of connectedness.
Sure.
Water flows, and, you know, without flow, there is no life. Mm-hmm. Water is the carrier of memory. I'm thinking here of the work also of Masaru Emoto. The beautiful crystal structures that they've been able to photograph, and they can see how the structure of water is actually affected by emotional vibrations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many of us already have known that, but to see it actually there in photographs is pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine who's a healer has also pointed out that there's an increase in the number of malfunctions of the lymph system, which is like one of the waterworks of the body. And the lymph system needs to be working well in order to deal with various toxins in the body. It's not the only system that deals with toxins, but it's a very important one.
It's a really, really important one, yes.
Absolutely.
Yep. Mm. Yeah, as evidenced by all the lymphomas that are going on, that lymph
exactly.
has to move, and that's why movement is so significant. There's no heart to pump the lymph. That's
yeah.
moved by the momentum of the body.
Yeah. The other thing that seems to be very particular to Orcus, first, there's this, if we just think vaguely in terms of, okay, themes, there seems to be this matrilineal theme.
Right.
And when I first came across that, I thought, ah, well, if Orcus is carrying that very powerful charge of this deep, instinctual, primordial feminine energy, then by definition it must be like an agent of healing of the wounded feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And I then had some spectacular examples of that in the form of clients with their stories who had never heard of Orcus, and I never mentioned Orcus, didn't say anything at all. And this kind of came out in terms of work they were doing and very specific stuff. It was amazing, you know. I also have noticed, I've had a number of clients who've had Orcus in very significant places with transits, and they've been wonderful in terms of tracking it with me and reporting back to, you know, what happened on the days when it was absolutely exact. And one of the things that's very interesting, it's as if I called Orcus perception sea eyes. I then discovered there was a book called that. This is a nice little story. A book called Sea Eyes. And how I discovered that was when I was Googling around to see what else was out there or whatever, I came across this beautiful blog written about journeys to visit the Orcas. And it was written by an astrologer. So
mm-hmm.
I thought, wow, interesting. And I wrote to her, and it turned out she'd written this book called Sea Eyes.
Is she from the Pacific Northwest in the U.S.?
No. Turned out she lived about 20 minutes away from where I do in England. And I had no idea where literally in the world. I thought she could be out on some island somewhere.
Right.
But that was amazing. But sea eyes, in a generic sense, means something like the capacity to see what's going on under the water. And if we translate that symbolically, it's the capacity to see and register and know and feel stuff that's going on in the water field, the emotional field, in a room, between two people, within oneself,
mm-hmm.
but to see it in such a way that one isn't dragged under by it.
Mm-hmm.
And so
there's not a double drowning.
Exactly. So incredibly empowering. And one little anecdote I must recount, because remember I said Orcus is associated with Lord of Wealth. So on one of the days where a transit of this client of mine was exact, and when she reported back to me, she said, well, she said, I know this is going to sound banal, but on that day I had to have an appointment with my bank manager. And I thought, oh, well, cool. She said, no, but that wasn't it. She then recounted how she suddenly saw he was trying to manipulate her into buying stuff or selling stuff, or I don't know what he was doing, something, you know, that bank managers do. And while that in itself wasn't anything new, it was like how she reported it was of being able to see so clearly what was going on that she was not emotionally reacting. She was absolutely clear and sort of even vaguely amused. So not hooked as in hooked, big fish, etc. So there's something about a perception that goes deep enough into the emotional field so that it prevents us from getting hooked.
Well, thinking in terms of Virgo, it would be nice to have that emotional perception filter through our cognitive abilities, and Chiron's certainly going to help that.
Yes.
And there's a bit of a mutual reception feeling when you think of Chiron as being an affiliate of Virgo, and Orcus obviously being an affiliate of Pisces.
Absolutely, yes. Symbolically, yeah, that's lovely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's also a kind of interspecies communication capacity. I've come across this quite a lot now with Orcus people, and this isn't restricted to sea animals, but people who have a tremendous affinity either with one particular animal species or just in general.
Critters,
yeah, that's cute. Usually you'll find that they have a really strong Orcus somewhere.
Interesting.
And now here's a weird one, but this I've seen this enough to know. I'm not just making this one up. Remember the movie Jaws that I mentioned?
Yes.
Well, Orcus seems to have an affinity with stuff to do with jaws. Now, the joint called the TMJ, the temporomandibular joint, is one of these extremely important pivots in the body that actually contributes to our capacity to stay upright. Now, it's only a little joint in front of the ears. It's the jaw joint where it hinges onto the skull.
It's connected with balance?
Yes, exactly. So if if the TMJ is out, it can ricochet all the way down the body into the neck, the shoulders, the lower back, the hips, the knees and the ankles. By the same token, if that's fixed, and of course cranial osteopaths and a whole variety of healers will know about this, that all kinds of really serious physical problems just melt away. So it's very, very powerful. Now, we all know about tension held in the jaw and how very revealing that can be to us, or how people set their jaw or recede it or whatever.
But, or grind their teeth.
So dental stuff and stuff to do with the jaws seem to be connected with Orcus.
Interesting.
And there's a whole range of, of jaw and dental maladies, which are actually incredibly common, that certainly mainstream dentistry in the UK doesn't even acknowledge that such afflictions even exist, let alone have the skill to treat them. In fact, they would ostracize and even harass people who believe in, quote-unquote, it's like people believing in astrology.
Except ghosts or boogeyman or something like that.
I know, but this is like in the face of all the scientific evidence, and it's basically The main thing there is this phenomenon called cavitations, which is holes in the jaw that are left by incorrect extraction of wisdom teeth, or sometimes by injuries or whatever.
That's called a cavitation.
It's a cavitation, and it's like an eroding hole in the jaw that can actually cause the whole jaw to break. I mean, dire stuff.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen this with Orcus under transit.
Yes, I have. And people who either discover that that's what they've got and or have it treated, usually Orcus is around there somewhere. And the man I know, who I wrote a bit about this on my website, I actually guessed this because this is a dentist in the UK who's one of the very few who understands this and knows how to work with it. And I thought, well, if this little idea of mine is correct, he's got to have Orcus really prominent. Well, it's only conjunct Sun and Uranus in the 10th house.
Right.
You know?
So he could be an innovator on the issue.
Exactly. And, you know, to discover them, it takes quite a high level. It has to be high-tech equipment to discover it, because they don't show. They can be completely symptom-free in the mouth, but they can be absolutely wrecking the health.
On many levels.
Yeah. On many levels, yeah. And so Orcus seems to be connected with that as well, you know. Mm-hmm. And this interspecies thing.
You know, I kind of had an encounter with an orca because one got separated from its pod on Vashon, near Vashon Island, where the ferry boats will stop to watch the pod of whales go by. You know, so they're the whales are it's an interesting thing about Vashon Island, maybe other places in that area, but the word goes out that there's a pod of whales going by, and can you imagine a ferry boat cutting its engines and floating in the middle of Puget Sound just so everyone can get a look at the pod?
Wow.
Well, so a puppy got separated from his pod and kind of was floating around, and I could always see it when I was near there. It would raise its tail up, but then it swam in and started hanging around the ferry slip.
Mm-hmm.
and adopted the people, and would no one trained it to be a circus whale or to work at SeaWorld. It would just hang out and sort of chatter with the people on the back of the back of the ferry, on right around the level of the car deck, right? So you get down to the car deck, and there he is chirping away. But it was a pup. It was a small one. You know, it was like a quarter of the normal size. So he's very adorable. And then they had to make a decision, which is kind of an anguished and carefully made decision of what to do about this. Leave him there or bring him back to his pod, which at that point was up by Vancouver. And they knew his grandmother was the pod leader. They knew that the mother was no longer alive because they would have been together.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the grandson or daughter of the chief, the matriarch, and they finally made the decision to capture it and spend all that money to conk it out for a couple of hours and put it on the helicopter and get it back to its family. And that was the decision that they made.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so it had this critter, this one. I don't know many other ones. I never met another one, but it liked people. It liked their attention.
Yes,
it seemed very charming and charismatic.
Yeah,
and it was a little kid.
Yeah.
So, you know,
there's a dolphin who's like the guardian of Dingle Bay in Ireland.
I think I've heard of this one.
Completely amazing, and you know, it's like the overseer of this little bay. And it comes right up to the boats, I mean, within touching distance. And it sort of follows the movement of the waves plunging in and out right alongside the boats.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go and swim with this one, although when I went, it was way too cold for me, even in a wetsuit, you know. But just being in the boat with it, extraordinary. They have such an affinity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because all these big sea mammals, they really are somewhat endangered because of the toxic assault
and the on all their the existence. Sonar, all of the
sonar. That's the other. Ah, that, thank you for saying that. Because the other thing about orcas, it relates to what some people might call clairaudience,
mm-hmm.
and
kind of extra level hearing. You can hear things that come in.
Yes, either that people have literally physically very sensitive hearing, which can sometimes be something quite difficult to manage in very noisy environments, but more than that, it can be either or both a capacity to sort of hear one's own inner guidance very deeply,
mm-hmm.
and that it comes in an audio form, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
Or also that you can hear, for example, the emotional tone or other realities through what someone is saying.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be having, you know, a kind of passing the time of day type of conversation. And in the vibration of the voice of the person that you're talking to, a whole world will suddenly
open
up. All
this extra information is coming through.
Exactly.
Coded along with it.
Coded into the sound, yeah.
Well, I have Orcus in the Ascendant.
Ah,
I
voila.
I just put that up on Tracy's website.
Voila.
And so it's right angular, and I really like sound, the whole world of sound. You know, I have almost no affinity at all for video. I've got great video equipment. I don't ever bond with it. But my audio gear, I'm all about it. I like radio. I don't I don't have any aspiration to do television. But radio. Now that's, and I feel like I can convey so much more using the theater of the imagination in audio and project my whole presence just through my voice, just through sound. So that's very interesting. And I definitely love critters. I mean, just give me any critter and I like it. So
yes, well, as you're talking now, I'm sitting there with your headphones on. I'm seeing you as a kind of awkward critter.
Yes.
kind of plowing your way through the sea, you know.
This is true.
Yeah. Well.
So, and I've got it square industria. Let's see what I've got. I did it.
Meaning you work hard, right?
Yes. Yeah, Eris is in the mix, and Child is right there, and Isis. So the
what degree is your natal Orcus?
It's 11 degrees and change. So 11 Cancer, 12.
Okay, because I've been looking at quite a number of charts where Orcus is around that, earlier.
You might want to check out Adam Yauch.
Pluto is opposite, coming up opposite that point.
See, when I... yes, it is. And, you know, Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys died a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yes. Yes,
And so I knew him in summer camp, and when I found that out, I started to feel this really personal connection to... And I loved the Beastie Boys before all that, and so I... And one of the ways I connected with Adam's chart, which I don't think I mentioned, oh no, I did mention it in my article about him, was that he has the moon conjunct Orcus. Now I had to rectify. I talked to his mom. His mom didn't like astrology. His mom was suspicious of astrologers. I managed to actually get her on the phone before press time, and she would not give me the birth time.
Mm-hmm.
So I. Took the time of that, and I got like 11:17 in the afternoon, in the morning rather, and you know the noon chart worked pretty good, and I knew he had a very strong connection to his mom from his chart, many planets in Cancer on the North Node in Cancer and so forth, but his moon conjunct Orcus partile right to the degree was really what confirmed to me that I was working with an accurate chart. That moon Orcus, I didn't have any of this information about Orcus.
Right.
I was just intuiting it, and you know, I think they're all good dogs. I mean, sincerity. I bring sincerity to these little planets, and they just kind of come to the party. And I thought, that moon Orcus conjunction, that's the look in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That's that deep.
Yeah.
Somewhat anguished, sensitive, soulful look in his eyes that is looking out at the world from very deep inside of himself.
Like two deep wells.
Yeah, that describes it. But then here he is, this sound sculptor. The Beastie Boys were geniuses of sound.
Of sound. Mm.
And I have never seen anyone like them in concert. And the way they did this clairvoyant thing with this empathic connection to the audience.
Yes.
And so here, this opens up that chart for me. I can send you the article I did. I've got the chart. I didn't put Orcus in, but it's
I'd
moon,
love to see it.
Cancer moon conjunct Orcus.
It's also just making me think, I must try to get hold of the birth data of that musician Paul Winter.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I think, probably the very first person to fully integrate animal sounds into his compositions.
Interesting.
He goes back decades already, and I've seen him perform live. He often performs in New
York.
You mean
with whale song and things like that, right?
Yeah.
Paul Winter
and the Paul Winter Consort.
Yep.
Just beyond inspirational.
Yep.
And I'm suddenly curious about where Orcus is there, but I think you'll like this one. Remember Obama's inauguration?
Yep.
The double one?
During the void moon, that then had to be redone again
that's
later
right,
that
because
night.
Because there was a kind of a glitch in the reading
Chief
out
Justice
of the
Roberts
oath.
Roberts consulted his astrologer and came back over to the White House in his limousine.
Quite. But there, it was the reading of the oath. So now, guardian of the oath, Orcus.
So where's Orcus when this is going on?
In the first chart, well, you know, that's...
I mean, the noon chart, when he takes office, there's an oath or not. The oath is not in the Constitution. It merely says noon.
Okay. Well, when he redid it, Orcus was rising within a couple of arc minutes exact when he redid it that evening.
Interesting.
Which was amazing. And I think that was zero Virgo or one Virgo or something, you know, very early Virgo.
Mm-hmm.
That was amazing because that just sort of, that was the clincher, you know.
Yep. Well, so Orcus must be at aphelion. It's not moving that fast, considering that I'm born in 64. I have it in early cancer. We're mid, 11 cancer, and now it's only gone about 50 degrees in the whole time. But that's how these planets are arrayed.
Yes.
I've always thought it interesting and have not heard any commentary about this except from my own meditations on it, that Pluto is pretty close to perihelion right now. It's close to the sun, and that we, in our era of history, have our Pluto square at about 35.
Yes.
But our grandparents had their Pluto square at about 60.
Yes.
First Pluto square. That's how much variance that there is. We take 20 years to go through, 22 years to go through a sign, and now it's more like 12 to 14 years to go through a sign.
Absolutely right. And, if you think about it, the whole meaning of the Pluto square, depending on what age it occurs, it's really interesting, because if you have Pluto square when you're already in your 60s, you will already have been prompted to think about aging and death and dying and finality and mortality, and that's a prompt to a deepening of the spiritual life.
But now we're having it
in our 30s. Exactly.
And there's a lot of people confronted with having to think about this stuff in their 30s now.
Exactly.
That mortality is something that stalks young people now.
Yes.
In a way that it did not in other times in history.
Well, I'm not sure about other times in history in
because,
general.
Because there was warfare and people died younger and that kind of a thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. But here we are, expected to live older, and still that shadow is influencing people and their choices.
Yeah, absolutely. Like. Mm-hmm. But I think, too, the kind of deepening of spirit that occurs on the back of Pluto transits, that's a real opportunity that comes at the Pluto square, even if it comes on the back of difficult events or painful recollections or whatever the particular scenario might be.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the purpose of the Pluto. The Pluto square is not there to give us a hard time.
Right.
Pluto square is there to consolidate whatever spiritual deepening has already come to us and help us to go further with that.
It's in this era, it's right after the Saturn return. I've always thought that was a really appropriate follow-up.
Yeah, absolutely.
If there's unfinished business at the Saturn return,
then
work on it at the Pluto square.
Absolutely.
And you've got that leverage point, that dependable leverage point.
Yeah.
That then leads into the Uranian opposition, which hopefully is a bit more liberating and creative.
Yes.
That you do something with that depth.
Yes.
Awesome. Good. Any thoughts on Chiron and Pisces on a personal level?
Well, I think that it's really an amazing opportunity, being as it is accompanied by, the grandfather of the sea, which is Neptune.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something about the healing power of the imagination, and we individually have the opportunity to really work with that. So it's like the power of the imagination to recreate our own experience, to invite healing, to change our mental state, and thereby also to change our lives in some way.
Mm-hmm.
That imaginative power, in a sense, gets very sidelined in times when there's a lot of left brain activity going on. And I sometimes think, given the explosion of amazing new technology that's occurred over the last two or three decades, but maybe the last two in particular, that all of us have been forced to fire really strongly on that left brain cylinder just in order to keep up, learn what we have to learn in order to do so, and to plug into and enjoy and use intelligently all this great new technology. But it fires very strongly on the left brain cylinder, and I can see the consequences of that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in my clients, people are so maxed out, busy, and most of it's to do with the left brain, that the right brain, which would be where the imagination and the intuition and the felt senses
and the imagistic,
exactly, image is the language of the right brain far more than the verbal language
the
skills.
The Bible's on the left side, and the tarot cards are on the, I think, nice. on the right
nice.
Side. And I think that I laugh at this accusation of men are more stimulated by visual this and that. I don't believe that that's true. If it were true, it would be all the women thumping the Bible and all the men reading tarot cards.
Yes.
But for the most part, it's the men thumping the Bible and it's the women reading the tarot
yes,
cards.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
One of my protests against all the left brain stuff is I refuse to keep a date book.
Oh.
I memorize my commitments. I figure if I can't
that's
remember
good.
What I'm supposed to do, then I shouldn't be doing it.
And so years
and years ago, I stopped carrying date books. And people give me them as gifts, and then I never do anything
right.
with them.
You pass them on.
Yeah, or they expire at the end of the year, and I collect them. An ephemeris
yes.
is good enough.
That is good enough.
Quite sophisticated. I mean, it tells you all kinds of stuff that you need to know more than...
That's more important, yeah. Yeah, so I do think it is like the healing power of the imagination, of the image, and permission to listen to those experiences of felt sense of something which is quiet and subtle and needs time and space in order for us to perceive it at all.
Yes.
That's kind of knocking on the door now. And only too glad to be let in. That's my
yes.
observation.
Mm-hmm.
So like a renaissance of the imagination.
Excellent.
Mm.
Yep. Well, I'm really glad that Chiron was in Pisces during the 1960s.
Yeah.
I think it would have been hell on earth if not for that influence. I think of it as the peace and love influence of the Beatles. That soundtrack, the emphasis on music.
Yes.
I mean, most people, I would imagine, I'm sure this has not been studied, but that their main association with the 60s is music,
mm-hmm.
not protest.
And
that's really been the enduring thing
that's the legacy, isn't it?
It's a musical legacy. Mm. Yep. So good for Lennon and McCartney and George Harrison and Ringo Starr for really helping get that imaginative. I mean, these guys were pioneers of the imagination.
I know, but now as then, because then we had Uranus conjunct Pluto. Now we have them square.
Yes, and Chiron's back in Pisces to
exactly.
help us
so,
out again.
Exactly. So we have the same two sets of energies, really. Mm-hmm. Whereas on one hand, there is shock, revolution, violence, tumult, even natural disasters, the whole works,
Yep.
And then on the other side, there is this Pisces energy. Mm-hmm. And to quote the famous phrase from the 60s, the feeling that all you need is love. Maybe back then, being the beginning of a cycle, thinking of Uranus and Pluto. And now they're in square to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like an opportunity to almost demonstrate the power of those feelings about mm-hmm. unity, about love, the power of the imagination, all that kind of thing. That's how I see it. Perhaps I'm just being wildly idealistic.
Well, we need
here.
To direct the energy. And by the way, Orcus is in a mid Cancer through the 1960s, and the Uranus Pluto
That's
square
right.
is going to come by and wake up that Orcus placement in all of those 60s charts at the
yes.
same time that the Chiron return is happening for everyone born in the 1960s during the next 7 or 8 years, if they haven't already had it. All the 62 people have pretty much had their 62 have had their
Chiron
return.
Yeah, just.
It seems to be happening a little earlier these days than it was at the beginning of my astrology career.
Oh.
And the Uranian opposition seems to be happening a little bit later, by a year or two.
Okay.
A year or two later. It seemed to happen to a lot of 37-year-olds. Now it seems to be more of 40-ish or something like that.
Okay.
I haven't actually graphed it. But so that Orcus is going to get woken up by the Uranus-Pluto square.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Awesome.
Because also, I mean, during the 60s, Pholus was in Pisces.
Yeah, I've got it in Aquarius, though. I've got it at the midpoint of my sun and my moon. And I went to Phil Sedgwick and I said, Phil, I've got Pholus at the midpoint of my moon and my Saturn. And he said, oh, then you should be the alcohol monitor at conferences. Oh, thanks. I always like something useful to do.
Yeah, right.
Give me something useful and I'm happy.
Yes.
So I could be the alcohol monitor. But it's at the exact midpoint of my moon and my Saturn. So that's a prominent little pholus. And, you know, since being made hep to pholus and
yes.
when I read To the Edge and Beyond
yes.
and met Robert von Heeren that same
Yes.
Upon arriving in Germany, I got a copy of To the Edge and Beyond, and at the same time I was reading that, I actually got to meet and work with Robert in Munich.
Wow.
Like, wow, I'm in Munich. This, and we had a copy of Pholus, Wanderers, Vichen, mm-hmm. Saturn, and,
yes.
and my girlfriend Maria at the time, we would translate it and, you know, hack through it, you know, a couple of bits at a time, and then I looked you up at that time, and von Heeren. Pholus is a fantastic. We're kind of in an age of Pholus right now. It shows up so often. The second discovered centaur, by the way, a little longer orbit than Chiron.
Yeah, it's about 90 years.
Yeah, and currently in Sagittarius, I believe.
It is, and what interests me about that Sagittarius placement is, you know, in the last few decades, we've seen all the outer planets, plus all the major centaurs, all go through Sagittarius, all of them.
Yes.
That's not even counting the faster-moving cycles like Saturn and Jupiter.
Yeah, Neptune's been there recently. Chiron's been there recently. Pluto's been there
Uranus
recently.
Uranus was in the... Okay, Neptune we went through in the 70s, Uranus in the 80s. This is roughly, you know, and Pluto in the 90s and on up, you know.
And
in the middle of that,
Chiron,
yes, in the 90s, and Nessus went into Sagittarius, I think, the very same day or same week as
yes.
Pluto did.
Yes.
So the whole lot. So it's like Sagittarius is it's the marked out territory.
The great attractor is there. So it seems
Absolutely.
To be going, giving them all this initiation, the sort of galactic
yes.
reawakening their galactic contact point.
And also, you know, as Pholus, which is going quite slowly at the moment, as Pholus kind of trucks through the Sagittarius degrees, of course what it also brings is an opportunity to revisit some of the transits that we may have had that were occasioned by any of those other outer planets plus the other two centaurs. And I've seen some spectacular examples of that. So if one had any transits made to any planets while the outer planets have been going through Sagittarius. You know, very often, transits of the outer planets, the experiences, they can't necessarily be digested or processed all in one go.
Mm-hmm. No, they take a while, and that's
yeah.
a good thing, too, that Pluto takes a few years to
exactly.
do its work.
Exactly.
Or we'd be blown up, I think, by it. We'd just
exactly.
lose our minds.
Exactly, it'd be too much. And so what's so interesting about now, Pholus is going through Sagittarius. It's the last one.
Yes.
So, okay, yeah. we'll still get Jupiter and Saturn and other, you know, Mars and the faster ones, but there's,
well, there's
no more.
Well, there's all kinds of, I mean, Ixion is there. There's all kinds of interesting things. And
there are.
Quatuor is there.
And isn't Asbulus in there as well?
Well, there's a whole.
There's a little cluster, isn't there?
It's huge. We keep coming back to it, writing about it at Planet Waves. It's like a whole lesson in the minor planets every time we go back to. Let me see if I can. How do I? Let's just click the ephemeris button. I'm looking at the magnificent website of Tracy Delaney. Have you ever played on this one?
I have indeed.
Serenu.com. It's
Absolutely
got everything you need.
Wonderful.
You can type other stuff in there, and she programmed the thing at her kitchen table, and remains one of my favorite people on Earth for bringing this to the astrology community.
Absolutely.
You know, as a gift,
Amazing.
As a gift.
Amazing.
And she is, she's not a bragger at all. But, well, actually, it was David Rell at the Astrology Center who said that if she can figure out something like the Varuna-Eris square,
mm-hmm.
she's pretty good, because there are a lot of people who can't program these things who can't even get it within the week or so, and she's got her calculations working. She can get this down to the minute. She understands how to use Astrodeans, and she can get those scripts working, and she's got
Fantastic.
This very methodical Pisces mind. She has this kind of obsessive perfectionism that she loves to get it right,
mm-hmm.
and the thing works. It's amazing how well it works. I mean, so let's see. Now we've got the Sun at 5 Gemini. That's correct. So now we want to do a degrees of zodiac sort at 360, and we're going to get an inventory of everything in every sign. But I'm going to skip ahead to Sagittarius and read off the impressive list of things that are in Sagittarius right now. It keeps getting better, and Juno's about to show up now. So true node, mean node, All right, they've been there a while. Kariklo, 10 degrees. Okoro, one of the centaurs, great attractor. That's not going anywhere. Well, it is. Actually, it is going everywhere.
Rapido, yes.
But it's on such a scale that we don't really notice that we're actually moving a million miles an hour right now.
Right.
How about that? And then that's followed by Hidalgo, one of my favorite pre-centaurs. It's a 14-year orbit, but it's just like a centaur, and it's one of the coolest asteroids that there is.
That's the one with the very elliptical orbit, is that correct?
It's basically a centaur that's too close to the sun to be a centaur.
Okay.
It's got to be something like that. It's got that elliptical orbit and that cool little glyph, and it's named after the father of the Mexican Revolution. And it's all about being a rebel with a cause, I think. And it also points out the hypocrisy of perfectly stupid social customs that make no sense at all, that no one says anything about.
Wow, that's one very of my favorite, centaur, isn't it?
Yes, one of my favorite examples of what Hidalgo points out is that in Latin American cultures, the man in a gay couple still keeps his macho because he's the one who does the fucking, but the bottom partner is gay, but the guy isn't, quote, gay because he's
but
how stupid is that? That's Hidalgo kind of a thing. Like, really, look at this. I mean, so anyway. And so Hidalgo's there, right on the Great Attractor these days at 1448. Amicus, another centaur. Nemesis, an asteroid. Conjunct Pholus right now. Wow, we've got Nemesis, conjunct Pholus. Conjunct Ixion, a triple conjunction of Nemesis, Pholus, Ixion, and then Hylonomy at 19 and change, followed by Cupido, who's quick. Oh, no, no, quick. No, that's a trans-Neptunian point. That's a hypothetical. That's hanging out. Then Quatuor is at 23 and change. Echelus, E-C-H-E-L-U-S, a centaur I have not worked with, is there. Galactic Center, Narcissus, taking up the rear, conjunct the Galactic Center.
Wow.
So I think this explains a lot about what's going on now, and all of this. Well, Pluto, somebody joked yesterday that at the press conference, without any press there, it was, I think it was Making the Gods Work for You, Lady. Caroline Casey, who said that proving she hasn't really studied the minor planets, she said that, though it was funny, that Pluto left Sagittarius, but the politicians have not figured that out yet. The reason they haven't figured it out yet is there's a herd of centaurs hanging out in Sagittarius, right at the gates of the galaxy, where there is a big centaur known as Centaurus, and the Great Attractor, and then Ixion conjunct Pholus right now with Nemesis conjunct that. So there's basically a complete orgy going on in Sagittarius, the kind of bonfire of the pseudo-spiritual vanities happening there.
Yes.
And I think we really do need to figure out that religion is bullshit, that it is a social control mechanism that's co-opted birth, death, sex, philosophy, cosmology. Please, guys, stay in your churches and stop meddling in politics. Jesus, please, people, calm down a little bit.
Well, sometimes when I'm teaching about the ninth house, and of course Sagittarius is the ninth sign, so there's a bit of a resonance there. To be provocative in that sort of direction, I say, well, most of the things that you read about in textbooks that are traditionally associated with the ninth house, like higher education, religion,
higher courts, higher self,
yes, all of those things, and even long distance travel and the higher courts of law, yes, you said that, and so forth. I say most of that is to do with what I call canned meaning, as in off the peg meaning, but the true area of experience, as I understand it, of what the ninth house is about, it's the awakening of the individual connection with that meaning. So all those other things, in a sense, are founded on a kind of a cosmology of a meaningless universe, which you have to then go and get the meaning about. But if you start from the opposite pole, knowing that we live in a meaningful universe, then in a sense all you have to do is join up the dots, or allow yourself to receive the experience of meaningfulness, etc.
Yeah, I think it takes a lot of work to block it out.
Yeah,
I think. But hey, if not for that, they wouldn't need us.
Right.
The philosophers known as astrologers.
Right.
Help people find some meaning. Hello, everyone. We're here to help you find some meaning. Do me a favor. Email me with some of that meaning because I need it.
Yeah.
They do, though. My readers send me great emails that I learn a lot from reading email. I'd like to know the percentage of astrology that I've learned in total from reading my email.
Mm-hmm.
People just send me stuff. It's like, well, that really is pretty cool. I'll write a whole article about that.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you've noticed this too. Your books are full of the things that your workshop participants come out with that are just brilliant.
Absolutely.
That are totally intuitive.
But that's how it works in a meaningful universe.
Yes.
Because meaning is everywhere.
Yes.
It's not kind of
a special thing
it's
that
not,
you
yeah.
pick at the boutique. It's
that's right. And it's not locked away inside, you know, an exclusive sacred text or behind closed doors.
No,
or
this is a kind of elitism that is designed to, I think, keep us dumbed down. Awesome. Well, this has been positively lovely, as
delightful,
I kind of figured it would be. Excellent.
Delightful.
So, yes, and so very happy to bring you this conversation with Melanie Reinhart. And you can reach her at melaniereinhart.com. Her email address is on there. Lots of cool articles on that website, including some great stuff about Sedna, which we haven't said much about, keeping your heart open in hell.
Huh.
Good old Sedna there, pointing us to the Arctic Circle and the Inuit goddess of the sea.
Hmm.
And you're one of the astrologers who likes to use the mythology a lot in your delineation. Not all of the good. I would put you up there like in the top five centaur delineators.
Huh.
Not all of them do. Phil Sedgwick pulls this shit out of the Aphelion, the Discovery degree. He's very logical about it.
Mm-hmm.
Juan Revilla refuses to use the mythology. He refuses to use the tropical zodiac even. But his delineations are bang on.
Well, I think it's a question of making use of whatever speaks to you personally.
And not depending too much on one thing, having a balanced viewpoint.
I'm also very keen on looking at the perihelion, aphelion, and other things like that.
Uh-huh.
In the revised version of Chiron, I go into a whole thing about that and say that basically I think that the notion of rulership, speaking of Chiron and possibly the other centaurs and the TNOs, mm-hmm. Kuiper belt objects of one kind or another, I think maybe the notion of rulership as we use planets, ruling signs, doesn't quite apply because they're not planets. But there are
I don't see any need to put it past the traditional planets anyway.
Pardon?
I mean, I think there's affinities beyond Saturn.
Yes, yes, exactly.
But Pluto is pretty Piscean in a lot of ways.
Absolutely,
Aries resonance too.
In the Alice Bailey system, Pluto is the esoteric ruler
of Pisces.
Pisces.
I see, right.
But there are all kinds of very interesting ways of sort of tracking where there is extra resonance, and the perihelion and aphelion are two obvious examples of that. And in the case of Chiron and the other centaurs, it's also the point where they cross over the orbits of their neighbors, go through Saturn or through Uranus or whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. Those are they're like gateways, portals, you know.
Mm-hmm. So the perihelion of Chiron is in Libra, right? It's in very early Libra.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, it's right around the Aries point and a big galaxy called M87, a big, big, big-ass galaxy that makes our galaxy look like a little cute little pinwheel.
Yes,
that little, it is.
A pinprick.
Yes. Awesome. Well, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric, as always. It was really fun talking.
Yes, awesome. Bless. All right there now. So this is, we're actually going to be posting this, have posted it as the first interview of Saturday morning. I know I've been previewing this in every previous recording. I have no idea if you're listening to all these recordings. I've tried to keep them all down to half an hour to make room for the one that I knew would go on for a long time with Melanie Reinhart. So that's awesome. And there are some, if you like this conversation, if you Google interview with Melanie Reinhart and my name, you'll find more of them. I think we've done three or four of these things over the years. Anyway, write to me if you can't find them. And we will be back in a little while with another exciting day of interviews here at Planet Waves FM. If you're at the conference, please do stop by our table and say hello. We'll be happy to meet you. And that is all for now. We're calling it a day. It has been a long day of interviews. I think we've done 8 of them or 7 of them today. Fantastic. All right. Thanks for tuning in. I will catch you tomorrow. Bye for now.